Tēnā rā tātou katoa, e ngā mana e ngā reo, e te iwi te ati awa Ngāti Tō Rangatira, e te awa tupua e ngā karangaranga maha hori no te motu, tēnā koutou katoa. Naumai haramai ki te whare tāngo o te motu te papatongerewa, naumai haramai ki te karanga o te kaupapi tēnei rā, te kaupapa nui i raro i te maru o te tiriti o Waitangi, naumai haramai piki mai kake mai. E te rangatira, te tumuaki o te koti whenua Māori, Chief Judge Joe Williams, kei te mihi atu ki a koe e te rangatira. Me koe hoki, e te rangatira, te upoko o te Law Commission, Right Honourable Geoffrey Palmer, kei te mihi atu ki a koe hoki. Me korua hoki ngā kaiwhakahaere mo tēnei hui huinga, Dr. Claudia Orange, Rawako Professor Matthew Palmer, kei te mihi atu ki a korua. Nō reira rau rangatira mā, ngā mihi anō ki a koutou katoa, naumai haramai tēnā koutou, kia ora mai tātou katoa. It's my great pleasure as the Kaihautu, the Joint Leader for the Museum of New Zealand Te Papa Tongarewa, alongside my colleague Dr. Seddon Bennington, Chief Executive, to warmly welcome you tonight to this wonderful event, a series of seminars hosted by Dr. Claudia Orange and Professor Matthew Palmer, who will work us through a process today. But I would like to particularly acknowledge Chief Judge Joe Williams, the head of the Waitangi Tribunal, actually recently announced today that he's been confirmed again for another term, and to the Right Honourable Geoffrey Palmer, the head of the Law Commission, who will be our panellists tonight to look at the treaty, its future, from a political and a tribunal perspective. I look forward to this debate, this discussion with you. Nō reira rau, rangatira mā, tātou katoa e hui hui mai nei, kei te mihatu anō ki a koutou, tēnā koutou, kia ora mai tātou katoa, kei a koe, Claudia.
Thank you, Te Taru White, kai hautu at te papa. And now kia ora tātou katoa. Welcome to the first of the 2006 Treaty Debate Series and Soundings Theatre Te Papa Wellington. The series is organised by Te Papa and Victoria University's Centre for Public Law. My name is Claudia Orange, Director of History and Pacific Cultures at Te Papa, and I'm chairing this session with Professor Matthew Palmer, Dean of Law at Victoria University of Wellington and Director of the New Zealand Centre for Public Law. The topic is the Treaty of Waitangi, where to from here, looking back to move forward. You'll be hearing shortly from Sir Geoffrey Palmer, President of the Law Commission, but the first speaker today is Joe Williams, Chief Judge of the Māori Land Court and Chairperson of the Waitangi Tribunal. The tribunal was set up by legislation in 1975, though its first sittings were not until 1977. Well, many at the time thought it a dead duck, but not so. It now has a 30-year record that is exceptional when compared with such commissions of inquiry around the world. Joe was appointed Chief Judge in 2000 and has today been reappointed Chairperson of the Tribunal for another term. He has brought a number of innovations to the Tribunal processes, and he brings his own views to the work and where it's going. Judge Joe Williams.
Tēnei te ara kei runga, te ara orangi e tūnei, te ara o papa e takotonei. This is the pathway to the heavens, the pathway to the Sky Father, the pathway to the earth. Tēnei te ara orangi rā ko papa e takotonei. This is the pathway between the earth and the sky and the earth mother lying here. Kia ra rau te tapuae o tāne ki raro. Nau mai te pō, tēnei te ao. Let the footsteps of tāne descend here in this gathering, bid farewell to the night, and greet the new day. Tihe, Māori ora. In the 20 minutes or so that I've got, I'm going to ask four simple questions. The first is, where's here? The second is, where is the treaty settlement process going to? The third is, where is New Zealand going to? And finally, how might the treaty be expressed on that journey that New Zealand is going through? Let's start with where's here? Where are we at in terms of the place of the Treaty of Waitangi, and most particularly in terms of my role as Chairperson of the Waitangi Tribunal, where are we at in terms of the modern treaty settlement process? Well, that process started in 1985 when the government at that time granted the tribunal retrospective jurisdiction to consider claims by Māori in respect of historical events well into the 19th century, all the way back to 1840, on the understanding, of course, that almost all of Māori grievances related to that period of contact and colonisation. In 20 years or so since 1985, the Tribunal has reported on claims covering 62% of New Zealand's land mass. And by December 2007, the Tribunal will have reported on claims in respect of just under 80% of New Zealand's land area, with another 12% in preparations or hearings. In other words, up until today, we are well past the halfway mark, and by 2007, the bulk of the inquiry and reporting work will have been completed. The Office of Treaty Settlements advises us that up until now, about $730 million has been spent on land claim settlements, covering, I guess, between 55 and 60% of the country, as well as settling the entire New Zealand commercial fisheries claim. Compared to Australia and Canada, New Zealand's process has, I think, by any measure, been exceptionally successful. Its pace has been significantly faster than equivalent paces in those two countries. The process for claims has been simpler and cheaper to run than anything on offer in those places. And the settlement packages have been a fraction of the cost of elsewhere. The process hasn't been trouble-free. That is obvious to anyone who bothers to look at our newspapers and watch our televisions. But I think it's fair to say that we've made more progress in Indigenous claim settlements here in New Zealand per dollar spent, per capita, and per hectare than anywhere else in the Western world. We should remember that. We hardly ever take the time to celebrate the fact that we have inquired into and negotiated our way through in 20 years what other parts of the world could only imagine achieving. Is there a gravy train? Well, if it's a gravy train, it's a very small train, and the gravy is very watery. If that's where we've got to, where's the treaty settlement process going? Well, it's now realistic to speak of settling all treaty claims in less than a decade from today. That's been made possible by groundwork done by the Tribunal in the 90s and a project assessing the depth and breadth of historical treaty claims in New Zealand called the Rangahaua Whānui Project. And as a result of revamped processes that were introduced by the Tribunal in 2000 and 2003. The Tribunal introduced a thing called the New Approach, which is a nice descriptive phrase, which halved the time that it took to hear treaty claims. In 2003 and 2004, it trialled in the Central North Island a thing called the Modular New Approach, which halved that halve. Excuse that English, so that the inquiry part of the treaty settlement process can be run at about four times the speed that it ran through the 80s and 90s, that is, if that's what the Crown wants and if that's what claimants want. If we are well over halfway through the process of inquiring into and settling treaty claims, what we're witnessing now in the 2005, 2006, probably through to the end of this decade, is a steadily increasing transition in these terms. You'll know that the Tainui settlement was done in the 90s, as was the Ngāi Tahu settlement, the fisheries claim settlement, the Ngāi Te Awa settlement, More recently, the Taranaki settlements and the settlements of various northern tribes much more recently. When all of those settlements are combined, the evidence shows that the tribes are steadily transiting from a grievance mode, which dominated the 1980s and 90s, into what I think can be appropriately be described as development mode, which is going to dominate 2010 to 2020 and beyond. In the next decade, the pace of that transition, the beginnings of which we're only seeing now, is going to increase greatly. And it'll be a cause for much celebration by those tribes who have got through the process, that their entire worldview, their entire paradigm will change over that time. None of these changes are, of course, occurring in a vacuum. And to that end, you've got to ask, where is New Zealand going? As at 2001, 585,900 people identified themselves as having some Māori ethnicity. That's 15% of New Zealand's population. Interestingly, in 2003, 45% of Māori births were to families where only one parent was Māori. So you are knocking on the idea of a 50% intermarriage ratio. There is unquestionably significant mixing going on. And I think it's unquestionable also that that significant mixing has been going on for some time and is to continue. So you've got to ask the next question, well, how Māori are those 600,000 people that ticked the Māori ethnicity box in the census in 2001? Well, let's take a look at that. In 2004, 30% of Māori children under the age of 5 attended a kōhangareo. The same figure for Māori medium primary education. 30% of Māori primary school kids are being educated in the Māori medium. When you get to secondary school, it falls off to about half that. But that's probably a reflection of the fact that the facilities are not yet there. That is nearly 40,000 preschool and school-age Māori children are being educated as native speakers of Māori as we speak today. Compare that with the figures in 1975 to 1980, when the New Zealand Council for Educational Research said if something drastic wasn't done, the Māori language would be extinct by the turn of the century. That's 5 years ago. In 2004, 11% of Māori adults did some sort of formal Māori language education program. 34,000 Māori adults went to school to learn Māori in that 12-month period. I think what you're seeing there is the wānanga phenomenon. In 2003, 136,600 Māori adults, about 42% of the Māori adult population, had a basic understanding of Māori, according to Statistics New Zealand. 21%, about half of that number, around 70-odd thousand, spoke Māori fairly well or very well. The picture I'm building up here is of a Māori population which is significantly intermixed, is large, is increasingly bilingual, and increasingly confident in its identity despite the mix. Indeed, intermixing appears to be invigorating Māori culture rather than diluting it. And you see evidence of that all around you in the media. Watch Māori television. Check out Whale Rider. It's interesting that in many ways Māori culture is a much more powerful and marketable product in New York, Berlin, London and LA than it is in Wellington and Auckland. But that's going to change. By 2021, the Māori population will have increased to 750,000. By 2016, 71% of the population will, according to the chief statistician, be purely European Pākehā. The equivalent figure in Auckland is an astounding 54%. Only 54% of the Auckland population will be European Pākehā by 2016. By 2040, according to Brian Pink, the chief statistician, who I might say is an Australian, so we can trust him, 40% of the workforce will be Māori or Pacific Island, what I call the Neo-Polynesians, as those two cultures, the Pacific culture, Pacific Polynesian culture and the Māori Polynesian culture, particularly amongst the youth, start to merge. Ask anyone from Ōtara or Māngere or Porirua, check out Brotown, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Those Neo-Polynesians will be an overall majority of the population at some stage during the decade of 2040. And these changes will be accompanied by a significant increase in the Asian population, reflecting the increased importance of China in the Pacific, in the world economy, and most particularly to us at the bottom of the South Pacific. Now in 2006, we are at the threshold of these profound changes. In fact, I think some of the most significant demographic changes since the change to a majority settler culture, a majority settler population, I should say, in the late 1850s. There is evidence all around us that the statisticians' predictions are well-founded. The Māorification of Kiwi culture is present so ubiquitously that we sometimes don't notice it ourselves. At what point did the Māori language become commonly used in conversations between non-Māori New Zealanders? Who said the national anthem should be sung in two languages? When did the haka become the most significant national cultural icon of this country? These are all the positive changes that reflect that we are at, or probably past, the tipping point into a New Zealand firmly placed in the South Pacific, where there is no single majority culture anymore. Interestingly, the flip side of these, what I might call positive changes, also reflects just this phenomenon, the rise in importance of race and treaty politics. The national political discourse is a reflection of the subterranean shifts in our very makeup as a people, and in that sense is probably a necessary rather than a bad thing. If the statisticians are correct, it will not be long before Māori issues and treaty issues shift to the very centre of national life, national discourse and national dialogue. Māori issues will no longer be marginal or minority issues. There will no longer be a dominant ethnic group or culture. National life will be characterized by constant dialogue and accommodation between these large groups of Pacific Islanders, Māori, Asians, and European New Zealanders, all sharing many aspects of a base culture and having distinctive aspects of their own cultures as well. That change over the next 30 to 35 years is the context, luckily, within which Māori will transit from an indigenous minority focused on grievance to an increasingly confident, increasingly strongly culturally based indigenous co-minority engaging in development. Well, if that prediction is correct, how might the treaty be expressed on that journey? I've got to say, I think that's a tough question to ask, and an even tougher one to answer. Unquestionably, the call for constitutional status for the treaty will increase, not decrease, with these demographic and political changes. But there will be, ironically, even less chance of a consensus around what the content of that treaty is, what it says to us, will be even harder to find. And it may be, just like the mid-1980s, that the politicians leave it to the judges to mediate that question. I hope I'm not a judge when they do. The heart of the treaty is power arrangements, the division between rangatiratanga, Māori autonomy on the one hand, and kāwanatanga, the authority of government on the other. I think the treaty will come to be expressed in political processes rather than substantive rights packages. We will be thinking as a country engaged in constant dialogue among these larger but no dominant ethnic group of processes that can be found to secure and affirm the dialogue itself rather than trying to find answers. One possibility is that the Māori Affairs Select Committee will over time morph into a Māori MPs committee with oversight as now of Māori policy issues and perhaps even with limited legislative powers, a kind of a quasi-sub-legislature. There will be a certain poetic irony in such a change. The question of the expression of Māori tino rangatiratanga will come to be reflected not outside or alongside kāwanatanga, but right in the middle of it, in the House of Parliament. That's a possibility, but there are so many others it's impossible to predict. The treaty, like all constituting documents, will change to reflect our own evolution as a nation. In fact, it is most powerful as a symbol of the unique circumstances of our conception and the fact that those circumstances keep speaking to us today and into the future. It is in that sense no different than the American Constitution or the English Bill of Rights or similar sorts of document. Like them, the treaty is an historical document, but it is not an historical relic. The last 20 years have seen our coming of age in important ways, our emergence as a complex multicultural Pacific nation whose links to Britain, though still very important, no longer dominate our national identity and culture. Completion of that phase in our development could not have been possible without a careful and public reappraisal of our colonial history, a genuine attempt at reconciliation between the state on behalf of all of its citizens and the original pre-colonial people was a necessary precondition for that emergence, a kind of rite of passage, if you like, for an adolescent nation. Thus, since the mid-70s, the treaty has been a symbol of grievance. It had to be. But as we emerge over the next decade from this reconciliation phase, the treaty will come to symbolise something new, I think. It will symbolise not the cost that Māori bring to the nation, but the contribution Māori make to national identity and life, to symbolise our commitment from the beginning to consensus nation building and to the rule of law, to symbolise our unique respect for diversity, a symbol of the fact that in this place, at least at the bottom of the Pacific, many peoples can live together in peace, inspired by their past rather than burdened by it. With the changes that the statisticians predict, we're going to need all the inspiration we can get. Tēnā koutou katoa.
Thank you, Chief Judge Joe Williams, speaking in the first session of the Treaty Debate Series at Te Papa in Wellington. And now I have much pleasure in introducing our second speaker, Sir Geoffrey Palmer, recently appointed President of the Law Commission. Sir Geoffrey was Minister of Justice and Attorney General for much of the Labour government period of 1984 to 1989, and then in 1989 he was Prime Minister. This was a key period of change in respect to the treaty, and he will look back briefly at that period and ask, where to from here? Sir Geoffrey Palmer.
e nā iwi o te moto, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, katoa. Can I begin by addressing myself to my distinguished co-panelist here by saying I learnt very early in my legal career it is never wise to disagree with judges, and that it's really interesting because, in a sense, this is not a debate between Judge Williams and myself. And we didn't collaborate in the preparation of our papers. And it's very interesting how they complement one another. There is a certain symbiotic relationship that I think will become clear. I am looking at the matter from a slightly different perspective, and I'm looking at it from a policy perspective and a more immediate perspective. The problem with a presentation of this sort really is to know where to start, because so much has been said by so many for so long. Indeed, the treaty has spawned a vast scholarly industry, and it is a literature of some distinction. And the great thing about that literature is that it's unique to New Zealand. And a lot of our expatriate scholars study it because it's very exciting and they kind of wish they were here. I'm not quite sure why they're not. It's quite hard to know which treaty prism to look through in order to distill insights from it, because in a funny sort of a way, Treaty of Waitangi jurisprudence, as it is developed in New Zealand, has become a very big field. When I was a law student, the Treaty of Waitangi was never heard of in the law school. Now, it's now become a field of Byzantine complexity. And that's just the law as it is. Debates on what the law ought to be have, it seems to me, in political terms, to have become unmanageable. The politics of the treaty currently seems to me to be a battlefield upon which people have become increasingly reluctant to tread. Now, it's not necessarily helpful to refer to my own political experience in the treaty field, although Claudia has, because although there are a lot of important treaty policy measures created by the government of which I was a member, in political terms, that was another country. There was no MMP, and MMP has transformed both the political and constitutional landscapes of New Zealand in ways that remain, in many quarters, I believe, inadequately understood. And in its latest iteration, MMP has given us a Māori party represented in Parliament, and while it is too early to divine what effects this may have on the treaty and its place in New Zealand society, it is bound, I suggest, to have some. To arrive at any balanced appreciation of where New Zealand is now located in relation to the treaty, it's necessary to see where we have come from in public policy terms and where we might go next. And I'll share with you at the beginning the conclusion I reach from that analysis. Clearly, we cannot go back, even if we knew what going back means. We cannot, or so it seems to me, pretend the treaty does not exist, ignore it, remove all traces of it from the New Zealand statute book. Not even the most muscular solutions that have been offered in recent times go so far. And neither, I think, can we rewrite our own history. Our history is our history. And we can argue about what happened and what it means, but New Zealand, as one of the oldest and continuous of the world's democracies, has a long history of dealing with the Māori people, and how New Zealand has performed as a state in respect to Indigenous peoples is a matter of public record. But what we do right now, in policy terms, is another issue. I am struck by the impression that while we cannot go back, there is no widespread will at this time to go forward either. So we are suspended in a place from which there is neither advance nor retreat readily available. Now, this may be no bad thing looked at in the larger view. There has always been an ebb and flow in the attitudes to the treaty in New Zealand. It started life as a sacred compact, only to be dismissed 37 years later as a simple nullity. Then came the phrase that the treaty is a fraud, then that the treaty is a Māori Magna Carta. But we do need to remember that the treaty is only part of the framework for Māori Crown relations and for Māori Pākehā relations. And the great advances for the treaty began in 1975 with the establishment of the tribunal, and a decade later when its jurisdiction was widened to deal with claims back to 1840. References to the treaty and legislation began to be made, followed by the litigation in the state-owned enterprises case of 1987, which was significant for the fact that the treaty began to be enforced in the courts, but only because it was referred to by Parliament in legislation. After that came direct negotiations with the Crown concerning grievances and the Māori fisheries settlements. Then there were the policies of devolving responsibility in the social areas to Māori organisations and measures taken to protect Te Reo Māori. And these were, in their day, I suggest, massive advances protecting the interests of Māori under the treaty. And all this happened in first past the post parliaments. And there was, I think, a significant measure of accord among the two main political parties of those days as to the essential components of the policy. That is not to say the policy was popular. Within the cabinets and caucuses of both National and Labour, the policies were tremendously controversial for the basic reason that significant elements of the population were downright opposed to all these developments or uneasy about them. Indeed, I wrote in 1992 when I was fresh from treaty endeavours in government. Let me quote what I wrote then. Disguised prejudice is never far from the surface in New Zealand whenever there is a debate on Māori matters. There is a dark and unpleasant underside to the New Zealand psyche when questions of race are confronted. These things I learnt only by exposure to the issues at the sharp end. For the much of the time, the truth is disguised under the egalitarian exterior of New Zealanders. I did go on to say there was much that was admirable in New Zealand race relations and that New Zealand had been much more successful in this regard than many other societies. But I thought then, and I still think now, that the most serious challenge New Zealand faces is to avoid having a permanent underclass defined by race. And of course, as Judge Williams says, in the end, the numbers will fix that, but not yet. In the peculiar constitutional framework of New Zealand, the protection for minorities against the tyranny of the majority is not well developed. And my theory, at least, in making the changes for which I had some responsibility, was to attempt to honour the undertakings of the treaty and to develop a modern policy framework for them. And I thought this would promote a sense of justice among Māori and give them an increased stake in society, and that such an effort would act as an insurance against marginalisation and against majority tyranny. And I think a lot was achieved in the decade 1985 to 96, but now I think in 2006, the level of controversy is so high that it seems to me in policy terms further steps, at least for the moment, are at an end. The implicit bipartisan approach that used to characterise these issues has been shattered. And it was inevitable this would occur in a democracy, especially an MMP democracy with all significant viewpoints represented in the political marketplace. And it is much better to have those attitudes out there in the open where they can be dealt with rather than hidden. Closet assumptions are never a firm foundation for progress. So it seems to me that where we are now is that the treaty is half in and half out of the legal system. And whether it is part of New Zealand's domestic law and can be enforced in the courts depends on whether it's been incorporated in the statute. And the constitutionally important judgments of the Court of Appeal and the Privy Council in the 1980s and 1990s were built on the foundation of Section 9 of the State-Owned Enterprises Act, which said, "Nothing in this Act shall permit the Crown to act in a manner that is inconsistent with the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi." Now, whether that theory of the matter will remain settled law is a matter to be argued, or could be argued, in the new Supreme Court. Remember also that the Supreme Court Act 2003, Section 13, provides that in granting leave to appeal a significant issue relating to the Treaty of Waitangi is a matter of general or public importance. And furthermore, one of the purposes of the Act is, quote, "to enable important legal matters, including legal matters relating to the Treaty of Waitangi, to be resolved with an understanding of New Zealand conditions, history." And of course, more than 30 statutes have been passed by the New Zealand Parliament that incorporate the treaty in some form or other, and these do give rise to interpretive difficulties. But there are some notable statutes where there's been an effort to try and work through in more detail the Maori concerns and deal with them in that way: the Resource Management Act, the New Zealand Public Health and Disability Act, the Local Government Act. Now, what I want to do is to say that there has been a very significant development in relation to Aboriginal customary rights, and the legal doctrine of Aboriginal rights that so consumed New Zealand in the Foreshore and Seabed saga is not strictly part of the Treaty of Waitangi debate at all. The legal rights that the Court of Appeal suggested could be found on further examination derived not from the treaty but from the New Zealand common law. And I doubt that one New Zealander in 1,000 understood that during the months of controversy that followed that decision. And indeed, while the level of public rhetoric about that was very, very high, I don't believe very many of the participants on either side of that debate had any idea what they were talking about. And that's not surprising, perhaps, given the complexity of the issues, because the doctrine of Aboriginal customary right is one of the most indeterminate doctrines of the common law. But it came to New Zealand very early, in 1847, when two judges sitting in the equivalent of what is now the High Court decided that the Queen was the only source of title to land in New Zealand, but it was burdened by the rights of the Aboriginal people who were occupying it. Now, I'm not going to go through that in any detail, but what I want to say is, it is fascinating to lawyers, I might say, but the issue now is what is to be done. I do think the place that we are at now is a much better one than we were in during the 1980s, despite the fact that that judgment in the Ngāti Arpa case was the most difficult judicial decision that any government has ever faced in my lifetime, I think. Māori are taking advantage of the new opportunities that have become available to them. The policies that I've dealt with have added to the capacity of Māori to take positive measures in health, education and commercial development. The Hui Tamata held in 2005 illustrated the undoubted fact that there have been many positive developments within Māoridom, and it does seem to me that Māori are moving away from focusing on past injustice and are actively pursuing fresh opportunities and not looking to government to bring, quote, "the results that we must achieve," unquote, as Sir Paul Reeves said when he was in the mihi as the convener at the Hui Tamata. So the issue becomes, given where we are, what is to be done? And I would say at present, nothing. Once the historical grievances are out of the way and there's been a period of consultation and reflection, and New Zealand will be in a better position to decide on what steps we then need to take to bring not only constitutional but legal clarity to the position of the treaty, and also the economic, social and cultural position of both Māori and Pākehā. I think after a pause we will be able to assess how the resources and health, education and the settlement assets and the policies of devolution have worked. The treaty is not now, and it never has been, and never will be in the future, a silver bullet to solve everyone's problems. And these issues have a history of moving in cycles in New Zealand, and another cycle of change will come on treaty issues that just isn't here yet. And the way forward, lies, I believe, in the development of ideas and policy options outside the political and government environment. Some further activity within the universities and civil society generally is required. And when a sufficient body of work has been done and some serious debate has been conducted, new approaches will arise. But they're not possible now. And neither am I sure what they are. But they will come in time. I'm encouraged that my son, who's sitting here, who has had considerable practical experience on these issues as the Deputy Secretary of Justice, is writing a book that will provide a reassessment. I do say that the scholarly community has much to contribute in this area. And one of the most difficult issues of all is the Treaty of Waitangi's constitutional position, because any rearrangement of New Zealand's constitutional arrangements will have to deal with the treaty, and there is nothing approaching anything like a consensus on that issue. And indeed, neither is the current legal position clear. But in any event, the formal legal status of the treaty may be much less important than its influence on the way governmental power is exercised in New Zealand. I'm old enough to remember that the Royal Commission on Electoral Law recommended as long ago as 1986 that, quote, Parliament and government should enter into consultation and discussion with a wide range of representatives of the Maori people about the definition and protection of the rights of the Maori people and the recognition of their constitutional position under the Treaty of Waitangi, close quote. That does remain, in my view, a sound recommendation. And it was echoed in the extraordinarily, or otherwise extraordinarily, cautious report before the 2005 general election on the Constitutional Arrangements Select Committee. That said, there should be specific processes for facilitating discussion within Maori communities on constitutional issues. Not that that was unanimous. Now, sooner or later, those things will have to happen. But before they do, we need some firmer analysis of the policy options that are available and other approaches we could take. It will take some years, I believe, to generate those and then to slide them back into the system of government, because I can see at the moment no clear direction in which to guide future government policy, just at the moment. But in the end, I'm an optimist about the treaty and its place now and in the future. We are a long way from 1840. We have accomplished much. And while there is much more to be done, I'm confident that developments will take place in the fullness of time, perhaps in ways we don't yet discern. Issues between Māori and Pākehā will endure in New Zealand, and so will the treaty. There are many hopeful signs. The New Zealand sense of national identity has been uniquely influenced by Māori culture, and tolerance and generosity of spirit remains a predominant part of the makeup of New Zealanders. In the end, our political system will find ways of binding us together on treaty issues, not driving us apart. But that time is not now. We need a pause for reflection, analysis, and reconsideration. We do not want, as Lord Cook put it to the inquiry of the New Zealand Select Committee last year, we do not wish to promote discord and confusion. These issues are not going to go away. They will have to face up and be dealt with, but they will change. As the expatriate historian Professor John Pocock put it recently, New Zealanders, somewhat against their inclinations, have come upon interesting times. It is to be hoped that they survive them. My message should not be misunderstood. While big policy steps are not possible at the present time, we are presented with the positive challenge to develop new paradigms and approaches, and this will allow us to face the issues that it is New Zealand's destiny to handle with enlightenment. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sir Geoffrey Palmer. You are listening to the first session of the Treaty Debates series in Soundings Theatre Te Papa on the subject, The Treaty of Waitangi, Looking Back to Move Forward. The series has been organised as a way of providing you, the public, with information on treaty-related issues and to give you an opportunity to consider and discuss these issues. We're now inviting questions and brief comments from the floor, and I'll hand over to Professor Matthew Palmer to lead these off. Matthew.
Inga mana, inga waka, inga reo, tēnā koto, tēnā koto, tēnā koto katoa. One of the aspects of the Treaty of Waitangi and relationships between the Crown, Māori and Pākehā that I personally think is most important is that of discussion, dialogue, exchange of views. We've had stimulation from speakers and we have an excellent and large audience of New Zealanders and also visitors from other countries here tonight. And you will see that there are microphones to the front on both sides. On both sides of the auditorium, they are available for any of you in the audience to ask questions. And if you would like to do so, please make your way down to the microphones now.
My name is Stephen Franks. I was one of the members of Parliament who I believe had something to do with the debate over the last 3 or 4 years. And of course, I've got hundreds of questions. But I have one that I'd like Sir Geoffrey to address, and I hope one that is more oriented to Chief Judge. The first is Sir Geoffrey welcomed that his contribution was symbiotic with the Chief Judge's. This is described as a debate. He welcomed the notion of debate in Parliament. But in fact, none of these addresses have addressed what parliamentarians have been talking about. We don't even get a debate in Parliament any longer. When we ask someone to justify the claims to the fake partnership or the spurious principles or the gaseous definition of taonga that's grown for the last 20 years or even the redefinition of the missionary term rangatiratanga, no one stands to take the point. The debate has in fact been a series of questions or challenges on one side and no one rising to answer on the other, and that's been the case in this discussion too. This, looking at the program, there is no one who is addressing in this discussion from the platform those issues. The second one was the vision that the Chief Judge has for our future, which I think he feels is driven by demographics. He described it as a national life characterised by dialogues and accommodation between large national groups, none dominant. First, why would anyone want to go into that? In that, looking around the world, it's hard to see any healthy democracy which is characterised by basically elite-brokered accommodations between racially or religiously defined groups. And secondly, why would we expect that to be a future where, thankfully, we like each other enough to live with each other, and the only reason why you might assert your membership of a large national group would be some, in 2 generations' time, would be some sort of artificially resuscitated tribalisation. In other words, it can't be genetic because that'll be mixed. What is the reason for welcoming a Balkan view of our future?
Can I respond to Steve Frank's first question by saying that I don't accept it. It doesn't seem to me accurate to say there was no debate in Parliament about these matters. There is the opportunity in Parliament to debate every matter. And for example, the foreshore and seabed legislation was debated at length. And a lot of the material can be debated at length. The difficulty with parliamentary rhetoric is that it becomes so exaggerated, so unsound and so full of cliché that the public turn off it. They get sick of it. And that is not the only forum in which national debate takes place. It has to take place in civil society and everywhere else. And I'm in favour of the MPs debating things. I remember when I was in Parliament, Simon Upton came to me when I was Leader of the House and said, look, the standard of debate's got to be improved here. Can we have a bipartisan agreement to improve the standard of debate? Well, yes. but the problem is, of course, that the political advantage lies in psychological warfare of a highly destructive sort in which sloganeering passes for debate. The only people who can improve that are the MPs, and Mr. Franks is unfortunately no longer one.
Judge Williams.
Good questions, Stephen. The first answer, I suppose, relates to the racial intermixing I talked about. On the one hand, you have this interesting phenomenon that with Māori, the level of intermixing is almost 1 to 2. Yet the level of Māori cultural identity and linguistic and cultural revival is much greater today than it was in my childhood. My children are more Māori than I am, and their children will be more Māori than they are. If you look at it in a purely linguistic and cultural sense, the level of identification with tribe, with marae, with culture, is much higher today than it was. You look at the shift in the Māori seats over the last 20 years and probably the next 10 or 20. You see that there's much greater attraction for Māori in registering on the Māori rolls than in the general rolls. This all reflects a fantastic cultural renaissance that's going on and a blossoming of creativity around that. I'm going to pick that point up now. A Harvard professor, whose name I don't recall, wrote a book called The Rise of the Creative Class. And in it he said that the most creative societies are going to be the societies that are most wealthy in the future. It is ideas that will drive wealth, not machines. And that the creative societies are the ones that are least homogeneous. And we are not the only Western society developing along that track. If you look at some regions of the US, you see precisely the same phenomenon. You look at Western Canada and Eastern Canada, you see the same sort of phenomenon. We have the advantage of 150-odd years of tradition of consensus and dialogue, symbolised perfectly in the treaty itself. We are wealthy enough to be considered a Western country. We are lovers of the rule of law and of engagement in the political process, and we are one of the most democratic countries in the world, if for no other reason than because of our scale. We may be one of the few countries in the world where the flourishing of diversity will be achieved peacefully, and the result will be great wealth, both culturally and in other ways.
This brings us to the end of the first evening in the Treaty Debate Series from Soundings Theatre at the Museum of New Zealand, Te Papa Tongarewa in Wellington. The subject, the Treaty of Waitangi, looking back to move forward. The speakers were Chief Judge Joe Williams and Sir Geoffrey Palmer, with a lot of help from the audience, and also from us, Matthew Palmer and Claudia Orange.